This is a HeadGum Podcast. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and possibly good night. Depending on when you're listening to this podcast, it's your friend Michael Cruz Kane back with another episode of A Good Cry. I don't know why I did all those sounds. I really just trying to keep it fresh. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I will probably not do the bow wow stuff the next time you hear this podcast. I promise. Unless you liked it, and then maybe I will. Grief thoughts for the day. I've been thinking a lot about how before I was a comedian, I used to be a tutor and teach kids how to take standardized tests, which often meant teaching them reading comprehension or grammar or math. And one of the things I loved teaching was based on the principle that you may have one preconception of how the world works, but there might be a totally new way of thinking of it that is also completely valid. And the way that I taught that lesson was by showing kids that 0.9 repeating is equivalent to 1. Again, 0.9 repeating is equivalent to 1. Sorry to take this detour into math for people who hate it, but 1/3 is 0.3 repeating, 2/3 is 0.6 repeating. So if you add those things together, you should get the same thing. In other words, 1/3 plus 2/3 is 1, and 0.3 repeating plus 0.6 repeating is 0.9 repeating. So 1 and 0.9 repeating are the same thing. And for a lot of kids, this blew their minds. It blew my mind when I first learned about it. 1 is 1. 0.9 repeating is like close to 1. It's not exactly 1. It's near to 1, but they're very different. In fact, they're the same. It's a paradigm shift to go, I think of 1 as clean. It's a number. It's right there. I know exactly where it is. I think of 0.9 repeating as messy. It's like not quite a number. It keeps going on forever. It's a similar paradigm shift when you first suffer a huge tragedy in your life. You thought that life was one way, but it is actually also this other way. And those two ways are the same. In what ways has grief changed the way you look at the world? I'm interested in that. Let me know. DM me, email me, etc. And I promise I'll get back to you. On this episode of A Good Cry, I talked to Lottie Bowser, who was introduced to me by a listener of the podcast, which is awesome. Thank you so much, Sophie, who pointed me toward Lottie and another guest that we'll be interviewing in the near future. Lottie's husband was diagnosed with cancer, and his struggle overlapped with the COVID-19 pandemic, and COVID-19 is eventually what took his life. We talk a lot about the ways in which Lottie has accepted the grief, has sort of brought it in, as she says, and what it's like to continue living after your person is no longer alive. This is an episode of A Good Cry with the great Lottie Bowser. Thanks so much for listening. Hi, Lottie. Thanks for joining me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're in Lisbon, right? This is, I think, our first international episode. We're going global with this one.
Ooh, okay.
Huge.
I'm honored.
I wanted to ask you the question we asked to start the podcast off, which is, how would you describe your relationship to grief?
It's been a tricky one. It's been really tumultuous over the last 15 months. But it's something that's here to stay. And I realized that quite early on from my losses. And I think that's enabled me to become more acquainted to it to the point where I befriended it. You know, it's a companion now. And actually, it's also a representation of the love that I have for the loved ones that have passed. So in that sense, it's a really sacred and beautiful thing, albeit one of the most painful human experiences I feel we can have. You know, there is some beauty in it as well.
First of all, that's a beautiful way of putting it. And it also feels like the way you describe it, it sounds like you have some measure of acceptance People talk about the stages of grief, which I think are frequently misinterpreted, but the acceptance at the end of it, I think, is one that people are frequently like, well, that's the one you never arrive at. Mm. And not to say that you don't feel pain and don't get angry about it or whatever else, but it does feel, the way you describe it, it sounds like you've like brought it in as opposed to trying to stiff arm it out of your life completely.
Yeah, I think I realize that resistance is futile in the face of grief. You know, loss is something that cannot be undone. You know, no matter how much time passes, the fact remains that your person did die and nothing can be done to reverse time or to change that. It's less about accepting the deaths and it's more about accepting the grief.
Right.
You know, and acknowledging the fact that it is going to be a lifelong process of integration. And while it might get easier as time passes, it's still something that you carry with you for the rest of your life.
Can you talk to us about your first encounter with grief 15 months ago?
Of course, yeah. So I'd lost family members over the years, like grandparents, but nothing that felt quite as catastrophic and as life-changing as losing my fiancé in November 2020. So Ben and I were together for 6-7 years. And in 2019, he was diagnosed with a really rare type of soft tissue sarcoma cancer called a malignant peripheral nerve sheath tumor. And he had a successful surgery. He had a successful course of radiotherapy, which was considered to be an insurance policy to stop the cancer from coming back. We got engaged on New Year's Eve of 2019.
That's after his diagnosis?
That's after his diagnosis, yeah. We thought, it's behind us now. You know, you've done what was needed to be done in order to remove the cancer. We can look forwards and we can sort of, you know, move on with our lives. And then 3 months later, it was actually 2 weeks into the national lockdown in the UK where I was living at the time. It was the day after his 36th birthday and we drove to his hospital for what we thought would be a routine checkup. And by that point, we were only 3-4 months out of his last positive scan result, which said that, you know, he was all clear. There was no sign of metastases anywhere in his body. And that morning, we received the news that the cancer had spread and it was in fact now in his lungs. And by that point, it's deemed terminal. From that point forwards, for the next 8 months, we did everything that we possibly could to try and ensure that Ben would be one of the exceptions to the rule, because there are people that overcome terminal diagnoses or at least are able to put the cancer into remission. He had surgery, he did chemotherapy. We literally threw the kitchen sink at it, Michael. We were doing repurposed medicines, THC oil, fasting, heat therapy, cold therapy, past life regression, counseling, you name it, we did it. We were even sort of meditating, you know, for hours every day, visualizing his cancer cells disappearing, visualizing his perfectly healthy body.
Were those kinds of things that you had practiced in some way prior to his illness? Or was it just like, now that he's sick, we're just literally going to try anything anyone says?
Exactly. We're going to try anything that we can get our hands on. And I would spend day in, day out researching, you know, amidst the caretaking, amidst all of the consultations and appointments and hospital runs. I would be at the computer for hours every day, well into the night, trying to sort of find ways to cure him. And this is during a lockdown, by the way, and Ben's now considered a highly vulnerable person because he's got cancer in his lungs. So we were in isolation. You know, normally these things take a village. When you receive a diagnosis like that, you need multiple hands on deck to to support the person going through it and to support their primary caregiver. But Ben and I were shut off from the outside world in our flat in London, trying to navigate all of this alone. So on top of all of that, we were doing everything that we can, as I mentioned, you know, alternative therapies, conventional treatments, and nothing was working. And fast forward a few months down the line, at the end of August, the NHS told Ben, there's nothing more that we can do for you. And at this point, we need to start talking about hospice. And to receive that news, it was impossible for me to accept. Looking back on it now, of course, it was denial, right? I refused to believe that the person I loved most in the world was going to die. And so in a last-ditched attempt to save his life, we ended up coming across this cancer center online in Tijuana in Mexico that was having really good results, treating terminal cancers similar to Ben's, really rare aggressive forms of cancer that don't have an awful lot of conventional treatment options available. So we flew there a few weeks later, and within 5 to 6 weeks, Ben was receiving, you know, good news that some of the tumor growth had been stopped in its tracks. And in fact, some of them were even shrinking.
Oh, wow.
And then, yeah, it was incredible. You know, we received that news. We burst into floods of tears because for the last 7 months, we'd been fighting tooth and nail, you know, desperate to try and find solutions. And finally, something was actually working. And then he was having a little bit of time out from the treatment because he was in there for 7 hours a day. And, you know, I didn't realize it at the time, but he was essentially already in end of life stages. You know, the cancer was so aggressive and so far gone that it really took a toll on his physical health, of course, but also his mental health. So we were having a bit of time out. And then the following week, he went back into the center to start treatment again. And he just proceeded to feel more and more unwell as the days went on. And at that point, because we were so focused on the cancer, COVID-19 became something on the peripherals of our awareness. It just wasn't, we just hadn't really factored it in. We thought, you know, we're in this cancer center, patients are really vulnerable, we're safe here. You know, it didn't even spring to mind that he could have contracted the virus. And then one evening, he was having difficulties breathing. And so he was on sort of oxygen support. And I was awake that entire night checking his oxygen saturation levels. I could see that he was in quite a lot of distress, feeling anxious and feeling really vulnerable. Didn't sleep a wink that night. And then the following morning, things just went rapidly downhill within the space of an hour. And I could see Ben becoming more exasperated and struggling for breath more and more. And at this point, you know, we're in a therapeutic cancer treatment center. This is beyond the doctor's remit. And, you know, it's questionable whether they were even doctors now at this point, because, you know, hindsight is a wonderful thing. It's a brutal thing as well. I could sense panic in the room. And of course, I couldn't speak the language. Ben was fluent in Spanish, but I wasn't. And at this point, he couldn't even talk. He couldn't communicate what was happening to him or what his experience was like. And things just descended into utter chaos. I could see Ben's oxygen saturation levels plummeting because he had one of the monitors on his finger. And the doctors said to me, we need to get him to the hospital as soon as possible. And because Ben was traveling as a terminal cancer patient, he couldn't get insurance. And in order to be received by A&E at the hospital across the city, we needed to put down a $10,000 deposit. Now, fortunately, which is not money that I didn't have that in savings at that point. Fortunately, we had an incredible response from our collective communities when going public with Ben's illness and when fundraising for him, because we wanted to explore alternative options, you know, pathways that were outside of the National Health Service in the UK. So I had the money, you know, I had to basically get Ben's wallet out of his pocket, put the deposit down. He was put onto a stretcher and rushed into an ambulance. And at that point, you know, I'm so traumatized because everything is moving so quickly and I have no idea what's happening, but everyone around me is very panicked and very concerned. So I know intuitively that his life is in danger at this point, but I have no idea why. You know, had a tumor ruptured, had something, you know, gone wrong in his lungs because that's where the disease was. We hurtled across town with the sirens blasting, like weaving in and out of traffic. They got him out of the ambulance and proceeded to rush him through the doors of A&E at the Red Cross Hospital. And that was the last I saw of him conscious. So they physically withheld me from going in. I tried to run in after him to be with him because I could see the panic and the terror and the confusion on his face. But because of the COVID-19 restrictions, they held me back. So I remember just dropping to my knees in so much shock and trauma and calling my family from home, at home, saying, you know, Ben's just been rushed into hospital. I have no idea what's going on. I think he might die. The ICU doctor, he was intubated straight away. So Ben was put into a medically induced coma upon arrival. And the ICU doctor said, we'll try our best, but your fiancé is incredibly critical. You know, he might not make it. And a couple of days ago, we just celebrated our 7-year anniversary. You know, we'd had a takeaway in the hospital. We were feeling really optimistic and hopeful. He had a bit of a tickly cough, but we just assumed that it was a result of all of the treatment. And that actually it was a sign of the disease, you know, being destroyed in there, that it was retreating. Fast forward 24 days later, you know, Ben has spent 24 days in the intensive care unit, going from stable to critical, stable to critical, day in, day out, sometimes hour by hour. Things proceeded to get worse and worse. And on the 14th of November, he passed away. He had multiple organ failure as a result of the severe COVID-19 infection that he developed, and he contracted sepsis. And the news came as such a shock to me because throughout those 24 days, I never gave up on the possibility that he would survive. Again, I think it's denial. I just didn't want to believe that he might pass away. And it was without doubt the most shocking, most traumatic, most painful experience of my life. You know, it was as though everything went black in that split second when I received that news. And I wasn't actually at the hospital at the time. I was just having a lunch out with a friend in a cafe nearby, waiting for the one call a day that we received from the ICU doctors to find out more about his condition. And they said, you know, you need to get to the hospital as soon as you can because Ben's about to pass away. And so I arrived a few minutes later after he died and had to put on all the gear, you know, the hazmat suit, the goggles, the hair mask, the latex gloves, and go and say goodbye to my fiance, my partner, the love of my life. You know, in those conditions as well, it was just, I still, you know, have intrusive thoughts about it, like even sort of 15 months later, you know, what I had to bear witness to in ICU.
I mean, there's so much about that that I recognize from my own experience. The falling to your knees is something that I really remember. And then also, like, once it's happening, how fast it's happening, and it feels like totally out of control.
Mm-hmm. Completely.
But the thing that's very different, like, you know, my son died pretty, like, once he became critical, he died very quickly. Mm. So your experience is different, I mean, in a lot of ways, but one of them also is the amount of time you spent battling for him. My brother had cancer when he was a kid. My dad had cancer. They both are still with me. But I remember how rough the treatment was. Like even the like chemotherapy and the, you know, all the different kinds of chemotherapy, and how hopefully in 100 years we'll look back on the way that we tried to get rid of cancer now and go, that was insane what we were doing. You'll know more about this than I do, but as I recall, you're basically poisoning him and you're just like, we're going to try and make him so sick that the cancer can't live anymore.
Precisely.
But of course, you're like poisoning the lake to kill the fish, but he's the lake. Mm-hmm. So the cure is more worse suffering.
Exactly that. With no guarantees of it even working.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something that I found really difficult to come to terms with, in that there was so much suffering leading up to the death. You know, the 8 months that we spent isolating, fighting for his life were horrendous. You know, to have had to witness what Ben went through, only for it to end up with him dying anyway. You know, and we think, I think back to all of the times where he was in so much pain and feeling so scared and so desperate and starving himself of all of the things that he enjoyed eating and the things that he enjoyed doing for fear of it making the cancer worse. And now looking back on it, it's like, fuck, you should have, I wish he just ate the burger. I wish he ate the ice cream.
Yeah.
You know, because none of it helped anyway. None of it helped. And that speaks to just how little control we actually have when it comes to things like this. I think it's very difficult for us humans to accept our powerlessness in the face of disease and whether or not we survive. But knowing Ben's history and how full of vitality and good health he was prior to his diagnosis, and knowing the full extent of the different things that he tried in order to, you know, reverse his prognosis, knowing that none of it helped, it just goes to show it's a complete lottery, you know?
Yeah, and there's also, I mean, I'm speculating, but hearing you describe it, it implies to me a tremendous love of whatever his life was, that he was willing to do all that. You know what I mean? That it's like, I'll forego all these things and suffer all of this because the things that I have in my life are worth me staying alive for. Like, I'm in this tremendous pain and I will endure this because I want the things that I have.
Yeah. And you know what, Michael? I take comfort actually from that. There's few things that are comforting in the face of such a traumatic loss, and any loss, you know, for that matter. But I take comfort in the fact that Ben did feel hopeful. And I think I instilled a lot of that in him. I would share stories of, you know, cancer remissions and stage four patients going on to give TED Talks and, you know, years down the line. And he was like, yeah, we're going to make this documentary about my healing. And, you know, despite what's happened, for it to have been so sudden and for Ben to have probably been relatively unaware of what went on that morning, and then to have been intubated straight away, so not conscious at all, that, you know, it's shit whichever way you look at it, but I take comfort from that, as opposed to the other possible trajectory, which would have been, God forbid, going into hospice like my dad did 10 months later and actually knowing, you know, what was facing you. It was always a possibility, but it wasn't a certainty, you know?
Right.
We still had those little flickers of hope.
When my son got sick, he also died of sepsis. And you know, this is like kind of a sacrilegious thought, but when the doctors are like, the situation has now gone from, you know, your son is going home, you're about to leave the hospital, everything's going to be fine, to if he survives this, his life will be very difficult. Like, it will be, you know, the most horrible things that I could imagine. I'm sure there are more horrible things, but what I was able to conceive. And, you know, just imagine the amount of suffering he was in. There was a part of me when he died that was like, this, given where we've gotten to now, maybe it's okay that he's dying. Like, maybe that is freedom for him from us, you know, doing every crazy thing we could possibly imagine to sustain a life that would be full of pain.
Mm-hmm. You guys must have had, so your wife was received the news prior to your twins' birth, right? That something was going on. I can't remember the diagnosis, but that was it's a condition.
The twins were diagnosed with something called twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome that is like, has a very scary prognosis, but we managed to like come through that. Like with the, you know, again, our version of going to a hospital in Tijuana was going to this place called the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where they had what at the time was a relatively new procedure where they would shoot lasers at the placenta and reallocate the nutrients, which I'm very crudely describing. And anyone who listens to this and knows about twin to twin is like, well, that's not quite how it works.
This is what us civilians can understand. Yeah, it's so complicated. Exactly. And it's the thing, you're suddenly thrown into this world of needing to be a fucking expert on all things science and medicine. And you've got no idea what you're doing.
And also the treatments are like, okay, and so what we're going to do is we're going to shoot lasers. And you're like, yeah, of course. Of course the lasers will be the way. And that, it worked though. Like the, you know, they came out on the other end of it and the surgery had gone really well. So for things to turn so badly after he was born was still a shock. Mm-hmm. But I think, I don't know, there's also like this, maybe I'm making this up in retrospect, but at least now looking back on it, it feels like we never really emerge from the anxiety of this is not going to be okay, I guess. Mm-hmm. Everything was so fraught. Nothing came easy in the pregnancy or in the birth or after the birth that you're like, if you were watching the movie of it, you would not have been surprised, I don't think, that it turned out the way it did because everything was so dark leading up to it. Mm-hmm. Which isn't to say there weren't like moments of complete joy and, you know, all that's scattered throughout that. But
That's interesting, isn't it? How those things can exist alongside one another.
Yeah, I read, or maybe I listened to you talking to something about that sense of guilt that it's like, oh, today I didn't cry. And I remember that phase of the after Fisher, my son's name, after he died, like, you know, the first day that you're like, oh, you know what? I didn't break down crying today. Is that, is it unkind or like selfish or like, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but for me, it's like, am I being a bad father to him by not being destroyed all day?
Totally. You almost kind of gaslight yourself, you know? You start to, even in the midst of the most painful experience you've ever gone through, you're still being hard on yourself. But, you know, one thing I've learned is that grief expresses itself. Grief manifests itself in different ways. I don't break down that much, actually. I don't cry that much anymore, at least. In the early days, it was really primitive, like howling, wailing, you know, explosions of like, of my pain. But it's not to say that it's not hard. You know, I can sort of feel anxiety in my chest as we're talking, Michael. You know, it's... It expresses itself differently.
I digress so far from what I was originally meaning to ask you about that I forgot it until this moment, which is when he died, was there at all any feeling of like, okay, now the pain of it is over? Did you feel that way at all?
I think it came about so unexpectedly, at least for me. Because I was in that place of absolute denial. I was spending hours every day journaling, visualizing, meditating, Ben being this picture of perfect health, our wedding in Ibiza, our children's faces, our future together. I convinced myself that he was going to pull through and we would have our happily ever after. So it was so shocking. It was so shocking when he did die, particularly because it was COVID of all things. It wasn't even the cancer, although I'm convinced that that caused him to develop such a severe case of the disease, because I had it also, but it was just a bad cough for me and a bit of chest pain. It was so unexpected. And I think because of everything that we'd done, you know, I fought tooth and nail, minute by minute, day in, day out, for 8 months to try and save his life, that I couldn't possibly reconcile with what had happened.
Sure.
And actually, part of my process was to replay conversations over and over and over again, to have the same conversations over and over again, to sift through dozens and dozens of emails, all of the medical papers, the statistics, Ben's sort of treatment journey from start to finish, to try and understand how we arrived at that point where he didn't survive. And now, 15 months on, I have made peace with it more. You know, I've come to understand that despite our very best efforts and despite our positive approach, you know, our positive mindset and our proactive approach, the chances of him surviving were slim to none. And that has helped me a little bit.
Yeah.
That no matter what we did, even if COVID hadn't have come along, it was quite likely that Ben was going to pass away.
Right. Even no matter what you had done, no matter what place you had found or what obscure,
yeah,
you know, treat, you know, we're treating it with herbs over here. And you're like, great, we'll try that.
Mm-hmm. It was just so aggressive. Like this particular, I mean, soft tissue cancer, sarcoma, has particularly horrific prognoses. The statistics really aren't that great. You know, it's a really shit one to get because not all cancers are made equal, right?
Yeah.
Like some have much better remission rates and survival rates than others. And Ben's was just terrific. And the fact that it came back 3 months after radiotherapy, which was supposed to be a preventative measure, at least for the next 10 years, you know, we thought we were clear of it for a good while. Within 3 months, it came back. So that gives you an indication of just how aggressive it was. And it's, you know, proceeded to spread like wildfire.
We talk a lot about different kinds of grief on this podcast. Losing a partner is something that I would characterize as like an unnatural loss. Like people don't expect that, especially at your age, to have lost someone with that relationship. Like I think a lot of people on this podcast, the most common death is the death of a parent, right? That's like, it makes sense in the world. It like, and I can see when you talk about like the period during which you're poring over all of these old emails to try and make sense of it, that really resonates with me because it's similar to like losing my son. You're like, well, the world's not supposed to work like this. So it like totally inverts your sense of reality. Like, oh my, nothing is, well, for me anyway, nothing is as I thought it was. I thought the world was this way, but it's actually this opposite way. Can you talk a little bit about specifically how you think or feel that losing a partner might be different? You've also recently lost your dad. Like mm-hmm. how those things are different?
Yeah, I mean, I would struggle to find another person in my life that is so interwoven within my day-to-day experience as a partner. I got together with Ben just after I turned 24. And so my formative years were spent in that relationship. So much of my identity became intertwined with him and with our relationship and with his life. And it felt as though we were just getting started. You know, we just got engaged. We were in the middle of planning our wedding. We were thinking about starting a family in the next 1 or 2 years. And, you know, there's a reason why we call it our other half, right? Because you are essentially a unit, you know. So much of your life is wrapped up in theirs. And when Ben died, it was like I died as well, except I was still in my body, still breathing. That's how I've often described it. Suddenly, not only did I lose his physical essence, but I lost my sense of identity. I lost my sense of home. I lost my sense of safety. I lost so much of my community. I lost my place in the world. I didn't know where I belonged anymore, you know? It's really a reinvention of the wheel from the ground up. It's like starting all over again, especially at this age. You know, I was 30 when he passed away. And we were on a trajectory to continue building our lives together, you know, and suddenly I'm the equivalent of widowed, you know, right on the precipice of this new chapter that we were about to enter into with marriage and with, you know, babies and things like that. So it just felt so enormous. And I remember those early days, it being completely impossible to imagine how I would survive the immensity and the gravity and the depth of the loss. And then, of course, slowly by slowly, as time passes, things do get a little bit easier, you know, and I couldn't have believed that at the start, but with the passing of time, those all-consuming emotions do start to soften. Fast forward 10 months after Ben died, my dad died. And it was a really quick process from the point of his diagnosis to him dying. And I feel like I'm still integrating that. I'm not sure if I've even started, to be honest, Michael, because Ben's death took up and continues to take up so much space. There's this thing called compounded grief, or like cumulative grief, you know? Mm-hmm. One terrible thing happens, and then another happens, and you just don't have space to come to terms with and to carry all of it. They are vastly different. I mean, my dad and I weren't particularly close, but because of that, there were different challenges with the loss. You know, there were things that were left unsaid, things that weren't reconciled, that I now have to make peace with, knowing that there'll never be a chance again to reconcile those things. But it is very different because my dad wasn't, you know, a day-to-day fixture in my life. But it has been really interesting, you know, kind of navigating those losses alongside one another.
You talk a lot about passage of time. Do you think it's all attributable to that? Or were there things that happened, I don't even know what they would be, that also changed the way you thought about Ben's death?
I mean, I was really proactive in my grief. I realized very early on that whilst I've got a great support network of friends, even though none of them could actually be physically present because I was isolating with my parents at that point, with my mum and stepdad, even though I had a great network of friends and family supporting me, after our conversations, after our interactions, they could go back to their seemingly intact lives, right? It wasn't consuming them in the way that it did me.
Right.
Even though that, of course, they had their own grief because they knew Ben, and, you know, they loved and continue to love him too. I realized that it was me and me only that was going to like pull me out of this darkness that I found myself in. And I knew that I would need to outsource some help in order to survive, you know? So I would spend hours scrolling on Instagram, looking at different hashtags, like, you know, hashtag grief, hashtag grief community, hashtag widowhood. And I would find grief resources and grief accounts, and I would look at the comments and I would connect with other people that, share that they also lost their partner. I would, you know, slide into their inboxes and say, hi, if you ever want to talk to someone, I'm going through this too. I would find it really helpful. I also found a grief integration coach online. I found her on Instagram and I started working with her a month or two out of Ben's passing, and she actually lost her partner to cancer too. So there was that shared experience and I got so much comfort from her, and she was able to help me unpack things and talk about things that other people, my friends, my family couldn't relate to as much as they tried. So very quickly, I was able to foster a strong sense of community within the grief space, and that really helped me. And I think just circling back to what we were saying about acceptance, I realized in those early days that try as I might, you know, as much as I want to, I cannot bring Ben back. Therefore, I have to find a way of being able to live my life still, you know, if not on my behalf, at least for the loved ones around me. I couldn't end my own life, even though there were moments where I felt like I wanted to, and then pass my pain on to someone else, you know. So those things really helped me. And it's weird, I don't know if you've experienced this too, but in a way, to have gone through something so utterly horrific and to have lost Ben at such a young age, it's almost made me even more grateful. You know, I don't sweat the small stuff anymore. I wake up and I think, fuck, what a gift to be alive. I'm so lucky. Ben would do anything for this opportunity. So it's not fair to not make the most of it. You know, I have to, if not for me, for him. And over time, it's been less about doing it on his behalf and actually wanting to do it for myself.
Which is also what he probably would have wanted for you.
Yeah, totally. And if the shoe were on the other foot, I would want that too. You know, I wouldn't want his life to just stop. I would want him to continue moving forwards and to make the most of what's left, because I also believe, Michael, that I will see him again. You know, I've got certain spiritual beliefs that have really helped me to carry his death. And that's a really comforting notion as well.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
You just talked about so much beautiful stuff that I wanted to talk a little bit about community, as you described it, because one of the things about losing someone so young is, at least for me, was the moment that it happens, you're like, oh, I'm the only person, my wife and I, we're the only people this has ever happened to. Even though I've seen it in movies and read about it in books, when I go out into the world and no one I've in my daily life has any idea what this is like, because when you lose someone who's lived a full life and you've had a full life with them, what you've lost is all of these memories, all the things that happened. When you lose someone who is young, what you've lost is all the things that haven't happened. Mm. Right? You talk about, like, we were about to have kids, we were about to get married. And I think, you know, every loss is unique in its way, but also there are sort of like these categories, and where you can find kinship and fellowship among people, and it can help you, you know, not move on, but like process the feelings you're having. So, in that community, did it take you, once you found this sort of community of widows on Instagram, which also is great. I feel like Instagram mostly, like most social media is horrendous, but there are times when it's like, oh, this is what this, like the platonic ideal of Instagram is sad people meet people who are likewise sad, and it helps them move forward in a way that feels healthy. Did it take a long time for you to trust in that community? Were there, how you talked about it, but can you talk a little bit more about finding like-minded people there?
Yeah, I as I mentioned earlier, I would just spend hours, you know, when things would really close in on me at night, I found the night times to be the most brutal in a way. Well, really every waking moment was fucking horrendous, let's be honest, especially in those early days. But, you know, at night, I would feel so lonely and desperate, and oh, it's such a sorry picture, really. Bless her. I love that woman, you know, 15 months ago. I would just be sort of frantically messaging people, and people wrote back, and you know, we'd exchange numbers and we'd WhatsApp each other and check in. How's your day going? Oh, I'm feeling this. Me too. I'm feeling that way. Do you want to talk about it? Yes, let's. Then we'd have FaceTimes and, you know, slowly but surely I had this amazing group of young people, both men and women, who'd lost their partners and who were also feeling really alienated from their friendship groups, because no one had experienced a loss like this. It was unprecedented for their community as well. And the first 4 months of my grief were spent in isolation. So I was, you know, the UK was deep in the depths of lockdown after lockdown after lockdown at this point. So it became such a vital lifeline for me to be able to connect with people online. And it was what got me through. And in those really dark moments where the pain was so visceral and I didn't feel like I could go on anymore, I knew that halfway across the world, my friends in Australia, also grieving the losses of their fiancés, were feeling exactly the same thing. And it might sound a little bit twisted, but there was a feeling of comfort in that, you know, knowing that I wasn't alone in my pain, that someone else felt the pain, albeit different, because, you know, the people that we lost were, you know, their own individuals and our relationships were unique. There was shared experience there. You know, we could really relate to each other. And I'd go as far as to say that community saved my life, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's something to listeners of the podcast, you know, whenever you feel ready for it, I would for sure encourage finding someone who has a similar experience to you that you can talk to about it. Because I think for us and for many people, like when it happens, there's a sense of uniqueness, even though your logical mind is like, I know I'm not the only person this has happened to. Your life experience, for most people, like you look outside and, you know, people are still jogging, people are still going to work, people are, and you're like, oh, this, I don't understand, this is insane, we're the only ones who know about this somehow. And finally coming to a place where being aware that that was not true was very helpful.
Yeah.
And like the people who started to come out of the woodwork, who, you know, friends of mine from grade school or whatever, who heard about it and were like, look, I don't tell anybody about this, but we had a son who died, or, you know, we had a miscarriage or whatever. And having all those things, exactly as you say, it's, you know, perverse, but you're like, these like horrible stories weirdly are making me feel better.
Yeah.
Like knowing that we're not the only people this has been visited upon.
No, you're not alone, you know, and you don't have to endure your grief alone either. You actually need community to survive. You need it the best of times. You know, we're social creatures. We need others. And particularly, you know, in these dark moments, lean on people. And if you're surrounded by people that, you know, can't relate, that don't understand, that have limited capacity to support you, if you don't feel like you're getting the support that you need, reach out, you know, find those support groups, look on Instagram, search for the grief resources and the accounts that hold space for this. Because whilst a friend might not have the capacity or the relatability to really hold you, you know, in your pain, there is someone, you know, like a fellow widow, like a fellow parent who's grieving the loss of a child, who can, you know, and who does have the capacity to be there.
You, speaking of grief resources, have also written a book.
Yeah, I mean, it's a workbook. Yeah, it's a workbook.
That's a book. To me, that's a book.
It's a
if
book.
It has book in it. It's a book.
It's a work. It's a digital workbook. There's a book in me. I'm going to write a book one day for sure. Yeah, my plan is to get to the end of the year with a book deal. It's one of my goals for 2022. But my friend and I, who I believe you're going to be interviewing at some point as well, Elodie, she lost her partner in a shallow water blackout. We had a spearfishing incident. And we started doing...
You were friends before this, or you met because of this like online grief community?
We had mutual friends that were actually connected through Ben, my partner, who passed away. And I was following some of her friends on Instagram. I found out what happened. It was almost like looking into the future, because her partner died a few months before Ben. And then when Ben did eventually pass away, I needed to reach out to this girl. And so I made it my mission to connect with her. I got our mutual friends to connect us. And she was still quite early on in her grief, and I think hadn't found anyone going through a similar thing. So we found a lot of comfort and solidarity in each other, and we would speak most days. And we realized that sharing our experience of grief and talking about it was not only helping ourselves, but also helping people online that were following our journeys. And so we started doing a couple of Instagram lives, and we realized just how much of a gap there was for these kinds of conversations and this level of openness and this level of support. So we decided we'd write a workbook, just a digital ebook, a digital book to help people come to terms with their loss. And we created journal prompts, worksheets, downloadable meditations to support people navigating grief. And it's been really well received so far. And it's been nice, Michael, because it's been a way for us to transmute our pain, you know, and to sort of find, while there are no silver linings, you know, there are gifts, you know, there are invaluable lessons, and there are means to turn something horrific into something that brings purpose and meaning.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'm doing this.
Yeah.
For however much it's worth.
It's awesome. It's invaluable.
But that is a thing. I think it's a tricky balance, because I do think that, and I've said this before on the podcast, that people will say everything happens for a reason when you suffer tragedy. And it's like, I don't love that, but you can make a reason out of it. You can be like, I can find a new purpose based on this.
Yeah.
Or that grows out of this, that can help me process my own feelings and maybe help other people as well.
Yeah, I think I had this feeling very early on, like Ben's death cannot be in vain. I have to do something with this, because then it's not that it will ever make sense, but perhaps some good can come out of it, you know. And if you're helping just one person even. I'm sure there are, you know, countless people that you help by having these conversations on your podcast. Then that's got to be something positive, you know?
I hope so. I mean, for me, it is also, and I don't even know that this is good, but it is also a desire for my son to live in some way. You know what I mean? Like he continues on and, you know, I don't know that that's part of your motivation for writing a workbook or being so public about it, but people will know Ben through the things you continue to do.
And people will know Fisher, that's it. And, you know, the person died, but your love for them didn't. And it is a way, it's such a beautiful way to carry someone's legacy forwards. And I would encourage anybody, you know, who has lost a loved one to think of ways in which they can keep the spirit, the essence of their person alive. And it doesn't mean necessarily writing a workbook or starting a nonprofit or, you know, launching a podcast. It's like just the little things, committing to living by their values or, you know, perhaps donating to a cause that they felt passionate about because, you know, they meant something and they still mean something. Right?
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about those moments in grief where you're like, oh, maybe I wasn't as sad as I thought I ought to have been. But I think one of the thesis statements of this podcast is that grief is like so much more complex than people give it credit for. And that there can be times, even in the midst of grief, where you are cackling with laughter or you are like having these like moments of joy that happen in the absolute darkest times. Were there moments that you remember in the middle of like, you know, how difficult that was for you that still bring you joy and happiness to look back on or even make you laugh?
One springs to mind right now, actually. So it must have been maybe 4 or 5 days out of Ben's death, which was so utterly traumatic and painful. And I was in one of the hotel rooms because I had to stay in Tijuana for 2 weeks to navigate all the paperwork, the cremation. We couldn't transport his body home in its, you know, in its normal state. We had to go through this whole barbaric, inhumane process over there. I remember stumbling across the drag queen filter on Instagram. And I was with one of my best friends, Jazz, at the time, who'd flown over to be with me whilst Ben was in ICU. And we were laughing our fucking heads off. It was so funny because it changed your voice. It put your voice sort of 3 octaves lower than it normally is and just drastically changed your features. You had like big gold hooped earrings on, pink lipstick. It was so funny and so silly. And that was the first point, I think, where I realized, my God, like, it's not a black and white binary one thing or another kind of experience. You know, we're so complex. Life is so complex. We have the capacity to hold many different things at once. And actually, if there are opportunities to switch off, to laugh, to feel even just a moment of normality and peace, go for it. Embrace it.
Yeah, go get it.
Go get it. Because, you know, don't gaslight yourself. Don't bypass the need to do whatever it is you need to do in order to survive the moment or the day or, you know, whatever. It's difficult, though, because, of course, the guilt is a massive part, I think, of the experience of grief. And for a long time, I denied myself of things that, you know, felt joyful, that felt pleasing. It just seemed so unfair that I was alive, you know, able to experience life and Ben wasn't. But I think I reached a point where I actually felt like I deserved it. You know, I deserved to feel good again. And coming back to what you said, it's what Ben would have wanted.
To talk about that sense of guilt, and this is maybe too personal a question, but you're a young person. Do you think about dating? Like after he's, like, is there a point at which you're like, okay, this feels okay to try to do now? Or is it, fuck it, never, I'm never going to do that again. Like, how do you, because I'm sure that's got to be a topic among people that you are in this community with on Instagram, that feeling of like, okay, well, now how do I have a romantic or like intimate relationships?
I won't lie, Michael. I've dipped my toe in again. I have dipped my toe in. It's, you know, it was always going to be complicated and difficult and just thwarted with challenges and things. But like you said, I'm young. Let's be realistic. You know, I'm a warm-blooded woman. I am in my body. I am having a human experience. I do want certain things for my life. I love love. I love loving. I want to be loved. I want to be with someone to share my life with, and I want to have a family one day, you know, if that's something that's on the cards for me. So again, I think I've been able to fast track through certain things that perhaps others in my situation have struggled to begin wrapping their heads around, because everyone feels their losses differently. But for me, I feel compelled to live life with a sense of urgency now. You know, when it comes to dating, I don't feel like there's ever going to be a time where you clap your hands and you think, right, I'm ready. I'm ready. It's all good. I'm over it. This is going to be plain sailing from now on. You know, your person died, but as I said before, you still love them. You know, you still love them, and yet there's nowhere for that love to go. So, you know, I realized it wasn't going to be plain sailing. It wasn't going to be easy, but I knew that companionship was important to me. So, yeah, you know, you got to go for it at some point.
Is it like, okay, when I talk about my son, there are some situations I find myself in, less so now, but around like the 10-year mark of his death, there were times when I would just say that my son was dead. We're like, no one was talking about that. We weren't all sitting around talking about dead children. It would just be, I'd be in a conversation with someone and they would ask me something and I would say, oh, and I also have a son who has died. When you are dipping your toe in, as you say, is there, do you talk about Ben? Or do you, like, that would seem to me, I hope I'm not saying something like horribly rude and or stupid, but that would seem to me that, like, at some point that's going to be a thing. Is it like, we're sitting down at dinner. This is my first time meeting you, just so you know. Or is it like, this person maybe doesn't deserve to know the most important thing in my life on day one.
You know, I actually tell everyone. And sometimes I come away from a first encounter with someone, whether it's, you know, a dating situation or whatever, you know, a new friendship that's kind of like sprouting. I'm like, fuck, maybe I've been a bit full on. Like, I literally just dumped my loss and my grief onto. I don't think they were expecting that. But for me, it's so fresh. And Ben remains to be such an important, integral person in my life that it comes quite naturally to me. You know, I want to talk about him. As we discussed earlier, it's what keeps that person alive. So I do tend to drop it in. You know, it is part of my day-to-day. It is part of a lot of the conversations that I have when meeting new people. Normally, it's really well received. I've had a couple of people react as though I told them I had chewing gum on the bottom of my shoe, which is really not that great. But it's awkward for people. You know, this is why your podcast, this is why, you know, all of the grief resources that are out there are so important, because it's a universal experience. Everyone is going to go through it at some point. And actually talking about it in this kind of conversational, casual manner normalizes it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I go for it. I don't hold back. It's a way of celebrating Ben.
I love that.
and making sure, yeah, making sure he sort of stays on that pedestal, you know, that people know that he's important and that to have me in your life means you also have to make space for Ben.
We're running long because I'm so fascinated by literally every single thing you've said.
But I've got time.
I wanted to ask one more question. Thank you for being here so long, which is, you alluded to this earlier, your like spirituality. Do you think of Ben as being someplace now?
Totally. I've seen it.
What does that mean? You've seen it?
I've seen it. I've experienced it on plant medicines, and I've had some wild experiences with mediums who only had my first name. They didn't have access to my Instagram platform. They didn't have access to any of the news stories. You know, I'm a logical person. I'm very open-minded. I love to, you know, believe in all possibility. But I also need, you know, evidence. I want to see it for myself. I want somebody to, yeah, to prove it to me in a way that, you know, feels satisfactory for me. I've had so much confirmation, so many amazing signs, so much validation, as I said, from the mediumship sessions that I've had, that there's no way that he couldn't exist still in some way, shape or form. You know, I think the death of the physical body is not the end. And if, you know, you're not open to spirituality, then perhaps you could at least get on board with the notion that everything in the known universe is energy and that cannot be destroyed, right? And we are 99.99999% energy, empty space, energy. Perhaps that allows people who are less open to that mystical stuff to entertain, you know, the possibility that there is more. And there's so much comfort in that. Like, why would you not reach for the things that do bring you comfort, even if it is a load of bullshit? You know, it helps me to move forwards every day.
Yeah, and I think, well, that's primary, right? Is like, what is it that helps you? I think of myself, no matter how open I try to be, my brain automatically like shuts down the medium. It shuts down. It's like, I can't. And really interrogating myself, it's like, why? Mm. Why not believe that this is possible? But when you talk about people who are that way, I have been reading this book that contains this chapter about quantum physics, which, oh my God, I profoundly do not understand. So I don't want anyone listening to this to think I'm about to say something that is true about quantum physics. But this is maybe just a rambling thought that I have that isn't worth, I'll just cut this out if it becomes nothing. But the quantum physicists believing that, you know, for a long time, everyone believed that humans were particles, that it's like you exist in this place. Here's you, like a particle is something you can hold in your hand. Whereas a wave is something that is in multiple places at once. And quantum physicists realizing, oh, all matter is actually particles and waves, depending on the circumstances. I don't know. I've been thinking about that a lot. I'm terrified to ask a quantum physicist about it and have them be like, everything you're saying is completely wrong.
Get someone on the podcast. That would be so cool you know, contemplate these concepts. I mean, so just to touch upon my mediumship experience quickly. So, I booked the session with, like under an alias, basically, like with my sister's email address, who has a different surname to me because, you know, my story is online. I didn't want her to find anything out. I didn't want to give any clues away. I wanted to give her nothing, basically. And within the first 5 minutes, she said Ben's name. She proceeded to tell me our family members' names who were on the other side, AKA who'd also left their bodies and died or crossed, the family members' names of people that are still alive. And then she gave me a blow-by-blow account from start to finish of what happened from Ben's first diagnosis to him dying. And she recounted things that had happened in consultation, during his treatments, during his time at the cancer center, during his time in ICU, things that only Ben and I and even only myself knew about. There was no way that she could have known any of these things. And not only did she do that, but she was also mimicking Ben's mannerisms and describing his personality traits down to a T. She would say things in the way that only Ben would have said. And she was also telling me things that were yet to come. So things that I could anticipate happening in my immediate future or down the line. And guess what? They've all happened. So riddle me that. Like, how do you explain that? You know, the only conclusion for me is that she was talking to Ben. She was talking to Ben. And, you know, I don't need to try and, you know, persuade you or anyone else. For me, that has been so healing and comforting. Like, he's good. He is probably better there than it is here.
Yeah.
You know, it's magical, I think.
Seems possible.
It's possible.
For sure.
Yeah.
Lottie, thank you so much for doing this.
It's been my pleasure. It's been really nice to talk to you, albeit, you know, like horrible circumstances, but
yeah,
it's been so lovely.
This was another episode of A Good Cry with Lottie Bowser. Thanks for listening, and I hope it helps. Hello, friends. It's me, Michael Cruz-Kane, from the episode of A Good Cry that you just listened to. If you enjoyed this episode, would you share, subscribe, rate, and review this podcast? I hope so. Helps us get cool guests, helps us get the word out, et cetera, et cetera. Also, we've got an Instagram account now called A Good Cry Pod. Give us a follow. Good Cry news up there, some grief thoughts, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, I'm doing my live show, Sorry for Your Loss, at Caveat in New York City on March 18th at 9:30 p.m. And the link for tickets is in the description of this episode. Hope to see you there. Tons of you came out to the last one at Photographiska. It was awesome seeing the people who listen to the podcast that I haven't met yet, and I'm looking forward to it. Okay, love you. You're the best. Bye. A Good Cry is produced by Radio Point and HeadGum with executive producers Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, Richard Corson, Daniel Powell, and Houston Snyder. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Bree Mattan.
That was a HeadGum podcast.